MSW Media.
So it's way worse than just both siding. It's because it's about money.
Prevail. Seja de Geneva programa pro politico.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimen organizado, dinero sucio.
Global corruption. Tabrotipo za democracia.
Y ahora,
ATP.
Et maintenant,
con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Gregolier.
Welcome back to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Ethan Behrman is here. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp Therapy Online. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit betterhelp.com/Greg to get 10% off your first month. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. The Prevail column on Substack has been going since November of 2019. I'm an early adopter. Lots of stuff in the archives about Rudy Giuliani, Leonard Leo, Brett Kavanaugh, Jared Kushner, Putin, Trump, Russia, Ukraine, and much more. Every piece at Prevail is free to read and always will be. No paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions are just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. Ethan Behrman, that's Behrman, is a multifaceted talent spanning law, technology, politics, and media. He has his own law firm. He has 25 years of business experience and 10 years of media experience. He had his own radio show, and he's been on networks like CNN, DW, France 24, HLN, News Nation, Fox Business, and Fox News, where he sparred with the likes of Jenna Ellis. Ethan is a member of the LA County Bar Association and has admitted to practice in California and the U.S. District Court Central District of California. He's a contributor to California State Antitrust and Unfair Competition Law, Matthew Bender 2018. We talk about this in the pod. And with all his free time, he is now the legal expert on Really American, so you can check out his excellent clips on their YouTube channel. It's always great to talk to Ethan. He's a delight. Always. He's just a super positive guy, even though, I mean, he goes on these shows, the belly of the beast, and spars with these people, but he's always optimistic and upbeat, and he's just a wealth of knowledge about all kinds of subjects, which is, you know, why it's so fascinating to talk to him. I hadn't seen him in a while, hadn't caught up with him in a while, so it was really great to, get his thoughts on things. I had like two full pages of questions and I got to like maybe four of them, which is good because that means we kind of went on interesting tangents and discussed things I wasn't necessarily planning on, but which wound up being super interesting to me. So we do take on the TikTok ban. We talk about that a little bit. We talk about housing and how housing relates to antitrust, which I thought is very interesting. We talk about the Supreme Court, and we talk about, you know, the fact that Trump is on trial, man, this week. It's like crazy. This is like a president of the United States, a former president of the United States, on trial in a criminal court, and he just has to sit there and take it, and there's nothing he can do about it other than fall asleep and pass gas, but, you know, whatever. So we talk about all of this stuff, and I'm grateful to Ethan for coming on. He's just, like I said, he's always a joy to spend time with. So you're going to enjoy this discussion. We'll have it for you in a moment. I have very little up front. Last night, it came out that the state of Arizona, which was in the news a couple weeks ago for its 1864 weirdo anti-abortion statute, has now tried to redeem itself by indicting a whole bunch of Trump associates in a fake elector scheme. It's mostly the same people that were indicted in Georgia, minus, interestingly, Kenneth Chesbro, or Cheesebro, or however he says his name. I suspect that he is cooperating because there was some scuttlebutt about that earlier, that maybe this would be happening in Arizona as well. And now he was in a position to cooperate there, too. Trump has not been indicted yet. It looks like he's sort of alluded to in the indictment. So we'll see how this all plays out. I don't know much about it yet. It really just broke. But again, the walls are closing in on this guy and on MAGA in general. Like, how many states that now this is the fifth different jurisdiction, I think, that's indicted people in his circle. It doesn't really scream deep state conspiracy when you have all these different jurisdictions determining in a grand jury that you're guilty of something. It just makes it look like, I don't know, you're just a big criminal mastermind. I don't like to use the word mastermind with Trump because it implies a certain kind of intelligence that I don't think he possesses, but you get the idea. It's the whole like deep state hoax. It rings a little bit hollow when like all of the halls of justice are against him because, you know, maybe it's just that he's a crook and that's why this is all happening. Two new names in these indictments, Boris Epstein, who's Trump's legal advisor or whatever he does. I think he's buddies with Eric. It's like Eric brings in these people and then doesn't do much. It's like Lara and now Boris. So Boris is under indictment in Arizona. And Christina Bob is another one. She's on one of those networks. I think it's OANN, I want to say. But she's a legal person who's very much closely associated with Mike Flynn. You know, was at the Willard the night before the insurrection, all that kind of stuff. So she's now been indicted. She was not indicted in Georgia. Boris Epstein was not indicted in Georgia. So now the circle is expanding. Giuliani's indicted again. Fuck that guy. Mark Meadows indicted again. Sidney Powell indicted again. Jenna Ellis, Ethan's old sparring partner, indicted again. So this is what happens when you do business and you're in Trump's inner circle. You get indicted because that's what happens when you deal with criminals. You wind up, you know, indicted, convicted, and ultimately possibly, you know, in the hooscow. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens with all this stuff. You know, I'm at the phase now where I need to see them convicted and actually go to jail before I even, you know, get up in the morning kind of thing. Like, what did Kate Moss say? If it's not 10 grand, I'm not even getting out of bed. I feel like I don't need to hang on to every little detail in these cases because it's like, I just want him to go to jail for his crimes. And until that happens, I don't need to know the details because I kind of know what happened. So hopefully that is what will happen. And the juries that we assemble to hear these cases will be of similar mindset to the grand juries that decided to drop the indictments. So again, bad week for Trump. Lots of napping, lots of farting, lots of losing. So it's a great week to catch up with Ethan Behrman. And I've talked enough. Without further ado, we'll be right back with Ethan Behrman.
His name was Pecker. He was a sleazebag. With his big shit-eating grin, he wanted Donald Trump to win. He ran a tabloid called The Inquirer. And if there's beans you have to spill, he'll pony up a catch and kill. For dirt he pays in cash, he is a little fash. Looks like a movie villain twirling his mustache. Because he's Pecker, and he's a hard-on. In court, Donald Trump gets his fart on. Pecker, the raging hard-on. Cohen is flipping and Pecker is dripping. Dirty Pecker, he's a big dick. Such a dick.
Ethan Behrman, welcome back to Prevail.
Greg Oliar, you know, I was actually thinking about you recently, and I was wondering, why haven't I heard from Greg in a while? And then you sent me this email, and I am, you know, I'm beyond excited to join you as always. I believe that you are the voice of our generation who writes in a way that speaks to me. I've been a fan of yours since before we ever met. And I think that that's actually how we met, is I think I DM'd you to compliment you on your writing. So thanks for having me on, man.
I think you did. And thank you for that compliment, which I take very seriously because I have a great deal of respect for you and your work as well. This is, you know, it's a mutual appreciation society here. This is where we're at now. So I've been following your stuff since I got back into the Instagram, because you're on Instagram a lot, and your stuff pops up there, which is great, and how I engage with it. So I've been you know, sneaking peeks into what you've been up to, and as usual, you're super busy, and I can't keep track. So the first question is, you know, what are you up to these days? Because I know you're on this Really American, which is a great YouTube channel, and you're the legal analyst there. So some of these videos that have been popping up, which are wonderful, you've been doing that. And nothing you say would surprise me about what you've been doing. You could say I've been going back to Minnesota and working on cars. Nothing would surprise me. So what have you been up to?
So I kind of went quiet for a while because I was very, very, very busy. So I was quiet on social media and everything else. And now, because I've been, you know, with my law firm and practicing law in court and all of those kinds of things have kept me busy. I have a family. You know, one of my children is a TV star herself.
Yeah.
And but then I connected with Really American. And I absolutely love the opportunity. I love what they're doing. Chip Franklin is on there, and he's an old friend of mine from radio. And I just think he's one of the best. And so when he called, I took the call, and I've been out there doing these videos, kind of picking apart. They're kind of shorter. So I try and do like 8 to 10 minutes here's a brief summary of what's happening with Trump and whatever's happening in his case and some unique angles on it. But that's on the Really American channel on YouTube. And then I do little highlight clips. I throw out on TikTok and Instagram and everywhere else. So thanks for seeing those, Greg.
Yeah, yeah. I have not been able to figure out TikTok. And I feel like what's going to happen is as soon as I have it on my phone. I've tried to upload videos and it doesn't work for some reason. I feel like as soon as I figure it out and launch something, Congress will make it illegal and ban it. I think that's where we're headed. So
that's an interesting one. So the law passed, right? At least the House of Representatives. Now the Senate takes it up, and it's going to be very interesting. Even if it passes both the House and the Senate, and President Biden signs it into law, by the way, the issue is that a number of different violations by specifically banning one social media platform. Because it's not the only one that has foreign ownership, by the way. Right. This one specifically has Chinese ownership behind it. And does national security, are those valid national security concerns? And are they sufficient to overcome everything from First Amendment issues to Fifth Amendment taking issues to various other business statutes and interference by the federal government? So even if that gets signed into law, it's going to be in the court system for a number of years before you have to worry about it going away.
Okay, that's good to know. I feel like as a national security issue, Elon Musk purchasing Twitter is orders of magnitude worse than whatever happens with TikTok. And I wrote about that at the time. I wrote about it in the moment. So it's not me. It's not some revisionist thing. Like, why is this guy who's clearly a traitor to everything, you know, democratic and you know, why is he allowed to be mucking around with this thing? That I will never understand why they didn't make us think about that.
And who was the money, right? It's not all Elon's money. His money, I think, is a minority of the money to buy Twitter. I don't recall the exact dollar amounts now, but you got some real interesting players that are funding his purchase of Twitter. But worse, let's take it a step further. You and I both love our rights to speech. And Elon doesn't let a guy on Twitter post publicly available data about the happenings of his plane. And he's a free speech absolutist. He's one of the biggest con men of the 21st century when you look at it through that lens. He's not about free speech. He's about free speech as he chooses.
He's about free speech for Nazis. He's about platforming Nazis, yeah. Really is about, you know, that seems to be his thing and his purpose, which is really weird. I have, and I was going to ask this later. I have two pages of questions for you, right. But we don't need to hew to them at all, really. we just want to chat and hang. But I get worried about the free speech stuff under a potential new Trump regime, and I'm worried about it even now because, you know, what happens is these guys like these Devin Nunes guys, these Mike Flynn guys, they wind up just like filing lawsuits against people for defamation that are clearly bullshit. Elon Musk did the same thing with, I think he sued Media Matters. I can't remember. And they, inevitably they get thrown out because they're all crap, but they still exist. They clog up the legal system. They're, you know, onerous upon whoever is being sued, obviously. And even if you wind up where the thing gets thrown out and this super rich person has to wind up paying the legal bills, it's still a big problem. And I feel like, you know, the purpose of something like that is to silence dissent, which is, of course, you know, bad. Kash Patel, when he went on the Steve Bannon podcast, which somehow still exists and is freely available, even though we're supposed to be opposed to free speech, promised that there would be criminal and civil, you know, measures taken against basically enemies of the Trump, you know, regime were he to be reelected. And I feel like that's kind of what he was talking about. What's your take on all that stuff as a, because you have some experience along these lines in your profession.
Yes. And defamation specifically. So, yeah. You know, it, so there's, oh boy, I'm not going to be a professor right now. I'm also an adjunct professor at Loyola Law School.
You can be a professor. We don't mind. I have a very smart audience here, Ethan.
It's okay. Yes, that's true. Yeah. One of the many reasons I love joining you isn't just that you're really smart, but your audience is as well. You have to be. And but briefly, remember, defamation, you have libel, you have slander. Slander is the spoken word. Libel is the written word. This is generally speaking, right? But the issue is what you're talking about is the use of the legal system to silence opponents.
Yeah.
And it's not specific just in the political realm. Business people will do stuff like that that has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with, I want to get something through. I want to silence critics. There are a lot of different ways to use defamation. And defamation is a legitimate claim when somebody says or writes something about you that is untrue, objectively untrue. So if it's, boy, I think your hair is gorgeous, that's subjective. If I say your skin is pale, that's objective. We can measure that your skin is pale. That's on a spectrum. There's an expert that can testify that in court. So it has to be objectively untrue, false. You know, there's the New York Times v. Sullivan when you're dealing with a public figure, that it has to be something, it's misnomered as actual malice is the term. And most people don't understand what that means. It means with reckless disregard for the truth or knowingly intentionally false, right? Yeah. So I know that this isn't true and I'm going to say it about you. And as a public figure now I can potentially sue you for defamation. There has to be harm that comes out of it. So the key is a little over 100 years ago, at least in states like California, and then there's states like New York and others have gotten, you know, kind of followed suit. We developed something called anti-slap motions. Slap is strategic litigation against public participation. And what that is that's when I'm using the legal system to shut you up, shut you down, stop you. I'm going to beat you into oblivion. Using my money, because on the plaintiff side for defamation, you're paying hourly to an attorney. And defense is you're paying hourly to an attorney. You better have money to litigate defamation with rare exceptions. There are exceptions where we work on contingency or EFF, Electronic Frontier Foundation might, you know, on a specific type of a case, or ACLU might. But the point is we created this law that says, no, you're doing this just to shut him down. And if you're found that you have done that, you have to pay my legal fees. So Elon Musk here against Media Matters, I am 98% sure he got that thrown out on an anti-slap motion, which means he had to pay Media Matters attorney's fees as well. So we do have mechanisms in place to stop these people from abusing it. But if there's anything legitimate about it, they'll get past the anti-slap motion. And now you've got to pay for an attorney. I am deeply concerned about a second Trump term that would involve weaponizing beyond what he did in his first term, but actually weaponizing, changing laws, leveraging the courts, leveraging Congress to his advantage. And in ways, look, we know there's a whole big separate topic here of Trump judges that were appointed in federal courts, where they're the only district court judge in a jurisdiction. And so you bring every single case in front of that judge because they're going to rule a certain way and do nationwide injunctions that are just absolute nonsense. So the Judicial Council actually said, can't do that anymore. So, I mean, this is such a big topic. I can go a million places with it, but I have deep, deep, deep concerns. You know, the first Trump term at the beginning, I was like, you know, we got systems in place to keep him constrained. Our systems were not set up for a president who will intentionally undermine them at every turn, and a spineless Senate who will go along with what he wants because he has taken over the party.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I feel like the media, in trying to both sides this, I talked about this on the 5-8 the other night, but I feel like the media has been so trained to both sides everything that they don't really understand what it means when one political party has been completely co-opted by, you know, fascists, and what that would do for free speech and free press in the event that these people, you know, take over. Mussolini literally destroyed the presses. Like, he, you know, went in there physically and they broke them so that they could not work and could not function. And it's going to be more of same. So I'm hoping that the, you know, the press, the quote unquote legitimate press, the Times, the Post, whatever, will kind of get their act together a little better as we go into, you know, the heavy campaign season. But I'm not horribly optimistic about this. They don't have a great track record, but maybe they will.
It's worse than that, Greg. You're actually being an optimist when you say that. And let me tell you why it's worse than that. It's because it doesn't mean there aren't great journalists out there. There are great journalists. There are good people who work in the media. There are. However, they're basically all owned by groups and companies that are profit-driven. And therefore, the both sidesing isn't just because they're trying to appease or present things neutrally. It's because they're being told they have to. Look what happened at CNN for a minute with that Trump town hall.
Yeah.
That wasn't a both sides. That was a, I mean, how do you explain that? You explain it because it's money driven. And it took an absolute uproar at CNN and the feedback from the rest of us saying, what the hell were you thinking? And you can't fact check that guy real time because you have to stop every 3 seconds. People would ask me that about going on Fox News, for example. They're like, why didn't you fact check everything? You can't. That's not a conversation anymore.
Yeah.
You have to pick and choose what you're going to fact check on. So it's way worse than just both sidesing. It's because it's about money. And there's not enough money. I played with my radio shows early in my radio career with doing NPR style or just always equal, hey, let's have a logical discussion about this. Those all had the lowest ratings of anything. And so you've got to turn it up to 11. And I mean, Spinal Tap is absolutely referential to this day. You have to do things that spice it up for listeners when you're in a for-profit environment. NPR can be less that way because they take donations.
Yeah.
It's different.
I call it the Morton Downey Jr.ification of the media, you know?
He was awesome, by the way.
Yeah. I remember watching that, like, I was like sixth grade or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, just loud.
Late at night, wasn't it?
He was on, maybe they reran it like in the afternoon because I watched it when I got home from school. Like, I don't know.
I watched The Addams Family. What were you watching, man?
I think I just had the same channel on and it shifted around. Like, you know, first it was G.I. Joe and then it was Morton Downey and then it became MTV one day and we were like, oh my God, what the hell is this?
Oh, that's the greatest thing ever when that happened.
Yeah, it was pretty good. Although at the time I was like, I want my cartoon back. What are they doing? So it's also probably bad that we rely on these super rich people to bail out these publications. I don't understand how media isn't profitable just in general because they're like, well, we're not making profits with this stuff when all we do all day long is consume media. How is media not profitable? I don't understand that.
I have an answer for that too.
Oh my goodness. Okay. That was a rhetorical question.
Oh no, it's really easy. And okay. it's nothing that people want to hear. And this is why an entirely user consuming supported model is so difficult. So it was technology killed the newspaper and media business and the television news business. So when we removed the gatekeepers and we said everything and everybody has a platform, which is really what happened, on the newspaper side, it was Craigslist that killed the newspapers.
Right.
Not saying it was necessarily a bad thing, but they made their money off of classified ads. The television news business made their money off of having three channels to choose from to watch your television news. CNN came on board. It was okay when it was just CNN. They didn't devastate the traditional news business. But then it went. Then it became Fox News. Then it became 18 other channels. Then it became social media. And I don't consume my media on one of three networks anymore. I have diffused the monetary base so broadly and widely. I can't sell the same amount of advertising to support having three or four producers on a single news program. I can now only afford maybe one. And at the local news level, these field reporters are doing their own camera work, their own editing, their own writing. There isn't a producer. And so it's this diffusion of the money. The money didn't, you know, continue to grow at the same pace, but they said, I'm not going to advertise over here now. Now I'm giving the money to Google. That's why states like, who was the first state? Maybe it's California, I think, passed it. Said, you're going to have to start paying local news that you are pulling the articles from for news.google.com. And Google said, no, we're just not going to link to them anymore. So local news is dead and dying because of that. The money isn't there, but it's tech. It's the tech bros. It's not that they're wrong or bad, but they never shared the money with the people who were creating the content. Even when you look at YouTube, you know, you have to have so many followers, so many subscribers, so many views. They have to actually view the ads to actually get paid for putting your content up on YouTube, where Google's making money every step of the way. They're selectively distributing those funds to people. I mean, it really is that, Greg. It's that bad. And there is not a great answer to it other than wealthy people continuing to fund organizations and or grassroots groups of individuals who support shows like yours. Like MSW Media and the various, you know, shows on that podcast network. And it's independent media. What listeners and consumers of this content need to understand, and it's really hard to twist people on this because our lives are difficult enough, is not only do you have to listen through every one of the ads that you hear during this show, or if you're watching it on a YouTube, you've got to watch those ads from beginning to end. And if there's a Patreon available, you've got to pitch in the $5 or $10 a month on Patreon. That's the only way that it's supported. And your support is what allows this type of media to be created. And it's absolutely necessary if you want it to continue. Not everybody can just do it as a hobby.
Yeah, no, it's true. I'm very grateful to the people that do this, that support my Substack and this show. And there's no way I would be able to do it if I wasn't having a revenue coming in for the time. It just takes a lot of time.
There's also ego
about it, but it's a time thing, you know.
But the equipment, the software, there are actual overhead costs with doing this too. I mean, again, so if it's just a hobby, that's great. But if you want good content on a regular basis with a unique, informative basis that you come with, Greg, look, I mean, if you're listening now and you haven't subscribed, I really, really strongly encourage you to subscribe to everything that Greg makes available. Subscribe to his Substack. Greg, you have a Patreon?
No, I don't have a Patreon. Everything goes through the Substack. I don't like
having people. There you go. So Substack. Yeah. Subscribe to Greg's Substack. It's really important. Thank you. And share with others.
Thank you, Ethan. I appreciate that. This is probably a good time to take a little break and bring in the advertisers. We'll be right back with Ethan Behrman.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go
go to betterhelp.com/Greg. How is your social battery feeling right now? Drained? Mine feels a little bit better since the eclipse, but it's been rough lately. I'm not going to lie. The winter is hard, I think, socially. Just, I don't feel like getting out of my house that much. It's cold. And I think just in general, you know, the pandemic and having to be inside and adapt that way has made me personally just less social and less able to, deal. And we have, I think, in this modern age, we have a lot of responsibilities. We have a lot of obligations socially. We spread ourselves thin, you know, and now it's the spring and people are going outside. There's more gatherings. You get invited to more things, which is great. There's like graduations, there's weddings, there's stuff going on. You know, what's the right amount of socializing for you? How do you recharge, you know, when you're not feeling it? Maybe you're the kind of person who like thrives around people. Maybe you need, you know, more alone time. There's different kinds of people, different, you know, on the sliding scale of introvert, extrovert, you know, it's hard to know. And one way that you can know is to go to therapy and talk it through, because therapy can give you the self-awareness to build around a social life that doesn't drain your battery. And I think everybody can benefit from this. As you know, BetterHelp is great, and I've used it before. You know, it really helped me get through a time that was not only emotionally hard, but hard to even articulate what my problem was to a normal person, because it was like related to my being on social media, which is another form of social, by the way. Social media, for all of human existence until like 20 years ago, this did not even exist at all. And I think that having to adapt to that is difficult. You know, it's challenging because our brains have not evolved to handle it. So, having a problem with social media, whether it's you're addicted to it or it, you know, emotionally affects you in some profound way, I think that's normal. And I think it's something that, people need help with, because it's not a natural thing that happens in the world. So again, this is something therapy can help with. And BetterHelp is a great place to access therapy. If you're thinking of starting, you know, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's convenient, it's flexible, it's suited to your schedule. What I liked about it is that it was fast. Like, I signed up and I was talking to somebody, you know, within the week, maybe even within a couple of days. And because, you know, when you feel like you need to talk to somebody, you want to talk to somebody. You don't want to wait like a month or 6 weeks or something. You want to talk to somebody now. So all you have to do, you fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch at any time for no additional charge. They make it very, very easy. It's like an app on your phone. I used to go out and do it in my car, which was actually a nice place of solitude, and it was comfortable. So I recommend it. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg. Okay, we're back with Ethan Behrman. Thank you again for saying all that. I have two pages of questions. We've gotten to one of them. Which is good. This is what I want, because if you're just going through the page of questions, it gets boring, and it means that the discussion isn't organic. You know, it isn't like the right way in my view. Now, you said something interesting before we turned the recorder on. You said a lot of things interesting before we turned the recorder on. But one thing that you were talking about was this housing conflict, and there's some sort of antitrust situation going on with the housing market. And this is something that we're recording this on Sunday, April 21st. By the time people are listening to this, you will have already made a video about it for Really American, which is available over on the YouTube. But tell me, because you didn't tell me what it meant, and I'm very curious about this, because I used to write for a real estate trade magazine in New York City, so I know a little bit about real estate. So what was your take on all of this?
Oh, no. Now I'm interviewing you for a second. It's Greg. When did you work for this magazine in New York?
It was right around after my kids were born. So like, you know, the late 90s, early 2000s.
Okay. So let me ask you this question. In the late 90s, early 2000s, single family homes, small unit buildings, So let's call them quads and smaller. So four units or smaller. So duplex, triplex, quad, small apartment building, single family homes. Who own those?
In New York City, which is, I think, different from other places, there are co-ops, which is cooperative housing, and there's condos. And I think I know where you're going with this, but a cooperative is owned by the building and the units are owned by the cooperative, which is a very, if you go back and dig into it, it's totally communist. It's wonderful. Where bands of people all pool their money together and start this organization that is enjoys tax benefits and stuff like that. And in order to buy into it, you don't get the, you don't own the apartment per se, you own shares in the building that give you the apartment. So anytime you want to, say, rent the apartment or sell the apartment to someone else, the co-op board has to approve all of the stuff. So it's kind of a, it's an extra couple of hurdles, but it makes the prices a little bit cheaper. And if you're planning to live there and stay there for a long time, it's better. Condos are just, the units are owned by the people, and the building itself is sort of managed by the HOA, the Homeowners Association, and you pay dues into that, which is the, which are less than the dues of the co-op board charge.
So let's go out though to Queens, for example.
Okay, which is where I lived. So go, yeah.
So who owns all the single family, duplex, triplex, quads before the year 2008 out in Queens?
I mean, it depends. I mean, they could just be the people that own them. If they're just, you know, dwellings that are, you know, just like a regular house in the suburbs, except that it's next to another house.
So that's right.
Yeah.
So it was individuals who own those, and it would, it might have been small mom and pop type investor. And when I say investor, I mean literally mom and pop. Hey, I'm going to buy that quad or that duplex. Maybe one of my family members lives in one of the units, and the other two or three I rent out.
Right.
But it's a small, whether, like I said, mom and pop operation.
Sure.
So what happened after the 2008 crash, 2009 housing crash, we found that large investment groups, Wall Street types, venture funds started investing in housing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what it's accelerated in states like California last year, I have some data that shows up to 34% of all single family home transactions were to investor class groups. And so when we talk about why housing is just out of control, I was having this conversation with a younger person the other day. And historically, the conversation was 25% of your gross income. That was the kind of the comfortable max went to your housing cost.
Right.
And in states like California now, it's 50% is become the normal. 50% of your gross income is going to housing. And that's unsustainable. And people can't buy houses. People can't afford to move. People are becoming homeless because of it. It's a disaster. Well, a big part of that disaster isn't just that large companies are buying single family homes and small unit buildings, because they always were the ones who were building the big buildings, because that's, you had to be a big company to do that, because the amount of money involved to build it. It's just that simple. But they moved into areas that it was typically you and me and or our parents or our family, immigrant families, buy a duplex. That's how they start building their wealth, their net worth in the United States upon coming here, is I'm renting out half. I'm living in the other half. That's how I develop some net worth. But it's big companies that do it. So here's where it gets worse. It's not just Wall Street that's screwing us in housing. There was a report that came out, and you have to forgive me, I don't remember the name of this tech company off the top of my head at the moment. I'm not looking at my notes.
Okay.
But this tech company, it was uncovered in Phoenix, Arizona. There was some research done by a pro-democracy group that found that all of these buildings for the same units, let's say three bedroom, two bath, 1,400 square feet, just as an example. Well, in this one area, all of the buildings were pricing their three bedroom, two bath, 1,400 square foot unit the same, and it was 15% higher than the rest of the area. And it's because there is a company, a software company, that it looks like, it appears, has gotten all of these landlords to subscribe in an effort to increase the profitability of their units. Well, that's a cartel. And I'm not talking about narco. No, that's literally the term in antitrust. I'm a contributor to the Matthew Bender 2018 California Antitrust and Unfair Competition Law Treatise. I studied this. It's called a cartel. And you can't price future pricing with others. That violates antitrust law. And so where this video that you'll be able to see on the Really American Network, I'm going to do a deeper dive on this, is that should be investigated by the Department of Justice and should be immediately broken up for a violation of antitrust law. Because if they're coming together and working together as a cartel, again, not narco, but those cartels, that's where that comes from, is I'm going to control the market so I can charge a higher price and make this highly profitable for myself. If they're doing that, this goes all the way back to, there was that movie on the Archer Daniels Midland, fixing the price of corn. That was that became a Netflix movie 10 years ago or something. This is part of the concept of antitrust. So there's two parts that people don't know about with antitrust. There's Section 1 and Section 2 of the Sherman Antitrust Act of 1890. I'm not going to do the full lesson right now. But there's one which is a monopoly, right? We all know what a monopoly is. I own the market. The United States says, no, you can't own the market. We're going to break you up. That's why AT&T got broken up and has become reformed itself like the Borg or something. I don't know. Anyway, I subscribe to AT&T, so I'm part of the problem. But where I've lived, they're the best service. So I, you know, there you go. Anyway, that's part one. But part two are these business practices that are illegal. And one of those is this cartel. So there's price fixing, there's vertical and horizontal price fixing. That's a whole topic that we can get into that I'm not going to here. But that is the first article I saw that shows beyond Wall Street consuming up so much of the single family housing, but that now Silicon Valley is getting their hands in it and potentially violating major federal laws.
That's interesting. So the price fixing, there's the word cartel. The other word that I remember, and I remember this from the baseball strike of or the dearth of free agent signings in 1985 in baseball, is because all of the teams were colluding with each other to set the prices of the free agents, and then they got busted doing that. So
yes, so. Yeah, I mean, no, and actually what's interesting is pro sports are...
Well, they have laws that protect them. That baseball is specifically exempted from antitrust. There's a law that just exempts Major League Baseball for that, but they still can't do that. That's why, like, collusion, all the Trump people jump on that word. It's like, it has more to do with Andre Dawson in 1985 than anything Trump was doing with the Russians. But
you know. Yes, that's right. That's right. And it's yes. Let's just say that. Save it for the video. Go to Really American Channel on YouTube and watch my video on this. I would appreciate that and subscribe there too. But anyway, I mean, there's a lot to discuss there, and it becomes, you know, Microsoft. Remember, there was the big Microsoft case back around the year 2000. You know, there are lots of examples, but let me put it this way: our country was doing a very good job of breaking these things up. Until guess who took over the Supreme Court and started changing that? The conservatives. They came out of the Chicago School of Economics and they said, no, we're being too tough on big companies. It's better for the consumer if we let them do some of this. That's the briefest of summaries. That's in the 1970s is when that started changing.
Right. Well, now we have just reactionaries to the right of Attila the Hun on the Supreme Court, which is not great.
I have an interesting take on that, by the way. You know, by the time you hear this podcast, the Supreme Court will have heard oral arguments on the homelessness issue of the right to camp. You know, that's been a huge issue here on the West Coast. The Ninth Circuit has been very clear saying if there is insufficient housing, back to the housing problem, mm-hmm. you can't force people off the street, essentially. You can't make them go somewhere because there isn't enough housing. And so the Supreme Court's going to take up this case, and it's kind of a done deal that in many people's minds that it's going to be at least a 6-3 vote, that they're going to overturn that and what came out of the Ninth Circuit, and they're going to be able to say, nah, we can start forcing people off the street regardless, right? They don't have a right to be on the street. I have to pay $700 or whatever to reserve that campground, you know, at the mm-hmm. state park. Why is this guy going to put up a tent that blocks the sidewalk, which, by the way, I've always argued was actually an ADA violation that should have been pursued by. I'm very serious about that. I know people who are not able to get around, and they're literally homebound because or have to pay for an Uber, and if they're on fixed income because of disability, I can't use the sidewalk. That's a really serious problem anyway. But I think that if the Supreme Court is not 6-3, I think it's 5-4, and I think it's going to be the one Supreme Court justice that I'm going to surprise you with. I think it's Amy Coney Barrett.
That's what I was going to guess.
Were you really?
Yeah. I know someone who is a federal judge, and I was talking to this person about the new Trump judges and was surprised to learn that, Amy Coney Barrett is actually smarter than the guys are. And all this stuff. That's according to this person. So I always guess that. It's like a wild card with her.
Well, I do think she's very smart. Really. I mean, I think she's very smart.
Yeah.
Two, without saying anything about anybody else, let me put it this way. With what we know of her religious background, I know based on that, or I 99.9% sure, she has actually read the Bible many times.
Yeah.
Because I know people that are in those types of groups, and they legitimately sit down and read the Bible through every year, that or every 2 years, whatever that is. I don't know her group specifically, but anybody who has read the Bible in its entirety and actually believes the New Testament and really believes in what Jesus said in the New Testament, then they're going to have a different view on homelessness than a typical conservative. And, you know, I have conservative friends and they're like, you know, the difference between you and me, Ethan, is you want to get them off the street and you want to give them help and housing and make sure they have proper mental health care, because I want them off the street too. It's not safe for anybody. It's not good for anybody. It's wrong. We're failing as a society. But certain religious conservatives, you know, and the typical conservatives, like, throw them in jail. I don't care. Just get them off the street, right? But the truly pious religious conservatives who actually know what their Bible teaches them have a different view. They're more in my camp of, hey, we got to get them housed. We've got to get them the help that they need. They're too many of them have mental illness, addiction problems, whatever. They can't care for themselves. Let's get them the help. And thanks to Ronnie Reagan, they all got turned out onto the streets and the community mental health care never happened. So it's the conservatives that caused this crisis, and they're the ones who refuse to do something about it. But I think Amy Coney Barrett's background actually lends her, with her legal knowledge, to understand why maybe this could end up being a 5-4 vote as opposed to a 6-3.
That's interesting.
My opinion.
We'll see how it goes. There's a line by, I think it was Anatole France, and I'm going to butcher it, but he said something like, you know, the law and its infinite wisdom prohibits the rich as well as the poor to beg for bread and to live on the street.
Oh, I love that. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
I don't know that line, Greg.
It's perfect. Wait, hold on. I'll find it for you after. But it's yeah. And it's a,
I love it's, that.
It's perfect. It's a perfect line. Now, I don't know. This housing thing is interesting because what's happening now, too, is, you know, people are locked into their. The interest rates are so much higher than they were even like 6 years ago or something. People are pretty much locked into where they're living now if they were lucky enough to get a mortgage at that time. And it's hard to get money out from equity. I don't know. The situation is very weird. I feel like after the market crashed in 2008, everybody tightened up the rules to the degree that they only hurt middle-class people but not rich people. So not the people that are actually doing all the predatory bullshit, but, you know, people.
Correct.
Like, you know.
100%. It is, and that's what's so – where I have difficulty sometimes with the certain aspects of our own party, which is But your policy actually hurts the middle class the most. Yes, you're helping the lowest income people who absolutely need our help. We need to be also watching out for the middle class. And in California in particular, we've done a very poor job of that. Between the rich doing what they do, which we know that they're always doing little things, and that, you know, so we know that. But sometimes our policies, like certain environmental policies, have restricted home building here in the state of California. That's killed our housing prices. Middle class, it's almost desperate here in California at this point for actual middle class people. It is exceedingly difficult now. And I would take that a step further and say it's not just environmental rules, you know, like our specially formulated gasoline, which is no longer needed in light of our electric vehicle adoption. I only have electric vehicles in my home now. We actually don't even have an internal combustion car at all anymore. And we charge at home and all that kind of stuff. But you squeeze the middle class in other ways where costs are so much higher. And the idea of progressive liberalism has actually harmed the middle class as much as the right wing. And we need to be readdressing that. It's important to help low-income people, but not do it in a way that crushes the middle class as well.
Yeah, well said. Because I think there's, you know, I'm very confident that Biden is going to win in November, but I'm very also sensitive to things that can hurt him. And I feel like that's the interest rates and the housing things can hurt him. Just not that he can control it at all, but you know.
I was arguing the whole time on the interest rate increases. I absolutely agree that, you know, Wall Street needs to pay more for money, and they should have a long time ago. It shouldn't have been kept at such a low rate when Trump had a hot economy. He absolutely needed to increase interest rates. He intentionally kept it low, specifically for his wealthy friends and probably himself and his own business. I don't know, but likely since he's in the real estate business as well, he did that for his donor class. And which of course then caused housing to also spike when you have artificially low interest rates, that makes it too easy for certain people to get into it. But there's no question that, and I argued it when they started jacking the rates up, I'm like, this hurts the middle class the most.
Yeah,
it does, because middle class carries credit card debt, has to get loans on automobiles, has to rely on the credit markets in our society. Because I'm always going to get one comment from somebody that says, "Well, just pay cash for everything." That's not how our society is set up anymore. Yes, certain people can get away with that and live their life that way, but the majority of middle-class Americans rely on debt financing. And when you jack interest rates, the group it hurts the worst is the middle class. And I've actually argued against, you know, Biden has done what he's supposed to do, and that's allow the Fed to do what they need to do. Mm-hmm. We know Trump was putting pressure on the Fed and was attacking and everything else and through his cronies in Congress, but keeping those rates as artificially low in a hot economy when Trump was president until COVID hit, and then we had a garbage economy, obviously. But the point is he, those first couple of years when he was in, those interest rates needed to start going up then. And so it fell on Biden to raise interest rates, his Fed. And I just think it's wrong, and it's really going to hurt Joe Biden, because I agree with you. I think he wins in November. I'm not as sure of it as you are. I think he wins in November. But things that were really out of his control are what people are dinging him on. Inflation's not Biden's fault. It's not. It's that simple. Interest, rising interest rates, not Biden's fault. But it falls on him because he's in the White House.
Yeah. No,
sorry, I went off. That, you got me all pissed off with
no,
that.
No, I like that's good. That's what we like on the show. This is good content, Ethan. This is what we want here. No, I'm concerned about that piece because people don't, you know, in general, just see what's happening and then blame whoever's, you know, happened to be sitting in the White House, you know, and that happens no matter what. But you know, if you pull way back, inflation is actually good for anybody that owes anybody money in that kind of way. It's actually 2% and whatever the magic number is, if it was a little bit more, it kind of does help the middle class, because the loans wind up being worth less than they were when the money was taken out. So it's all, I don't understand economics that much. I can do it to a degree, and then my head starts to explode, and then I just go turn the basketball game on. But the idea that all inflation is inherently bad is also maybe simplistic and reductive.
Well, some inflation is important as long as you have a growing population. I mean, we get into really complex topics of where Elon Musk is both right and wrong, because I believe he's a eugenicist deep down.
Deep down,
on the surface, wherever, but but he's both right and wrong. We have a problem in the West, and Japan is a great example of this, of a quickly dropping population due to a low birth rate. Yet environmentally, we need to be 1 to 2 billion people, according to certain experts, on planet Earth, and we're 8 billion. So low birth rates is a good thing in some ways and a really bad thing in others. From an economic standpoint, our low birth rate in the West, and the United States has been helped through immigration, which the right is so dumb about nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, George Bush was actually pro-immigration, if you remember.
I remember.
Because he was actually a businessman who cared about business. He's like, I need cheap labor coming in, right, which the United States absolutely depends on, not just for cheap labor, because they're taking low wage manual labor jobs, but also because the population, you know, and in George Bush's case, it was because he thought they would come in as Catholics and would be good Christians with a conservative moral in his mind, right? But now we have the crazy MAGA who are like, close the borders, and we wonder why the economy is not doing as well as it should. Remember, the U.S. economy has done as well as it has since COVID because of immigration.
Yeah.
It's not because our native borns are doing that great of a job. It's just not. We need immigration. We depend on it.
You know how in Ghostbusters, you know, where the EPA guy comes and he wants to shut the power off, and which would effectively release all the ghosts? I feel like that's what the GOP, you know, that's what they are now. They're just Peck, you know, coming, Walter Peck coming and saying, shut it down. And them saying, you realize if we shut it down, all hell will break loose. No, shut it down. And then they do. And then all hell breaks loose. And then they blame the Democrats for, I'm not sure why exactly, but.
You just blame the other side for everything. That's just knee jerk, right? It's just. Yeah. Hey, Democrats are to blame. Anything bad, Democrats.
Yeah, we are in disarray all the time.
Democrats in disarray. I mean, because MTG and Matt Gaetz aren't the best example of disarray on the right or in Congress of any. I mean, wow. We got a pro-Russia caucus. We have a pro-insurrection caucus. We have all on the right. I can't believe growing up the way we grew up, Greg, to be in a day, I say this to certain Republican friends of mine, I'm like, how did we get to the place where your party is the pro-Russia party?
Yeah. I say that all the time. Like, say what you will about the John Birch Society. At least they didn't like the Russians. You know,
the John Birch Society. Holy crap. Speaking of eugenicists.
Right. Exactly. and this is another thing. Like, I feel like, you know, I've been doing this podcast now for 3 years, I guess, and, you know, talking to people, and sometimes the topics that we have to talk about are just that shit. Like, I can't believe we're in a state of affairs where we have to be like, Ethan, what do you think about the third clause of the 14th Amendment? I mean, is Trump eligible to be? Why did the Supreme Court say that 14th Amendment doesn't say what the 14th Amendment says? Like,
I mean, you know, if I wasn't an optimist, because that's what's so funny, is I am that guy who's always like looking at the positive of things. If I didn't have that in me, and probably, you know, Zoloft, I mean, this was unfathomable in the 70s and 80s that we would be facing what we're facing today. Even into the 90s, I mean, look, we were able to be the slackers, the forgotten generation, because, well, you know, Soviet Union lost, they're breaking up. Nuclear war seems to be much less of a possibility. Ukraine, we signed the Budapest Memorandum. Ukraine's turning over all of their nuclear weapons in exchange for sovereignty and respect of their.
Oh, and us protecting them and Russia not invading them. That.
And so, you know, we went through all of that and it was so, and the tech boom was happening and it was easy to be a, you know, this kind of behind the scenes, quiet generation, forgotten generation optimist, even though we were sarcastic and we didn't trust the system and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Boomers, you know, we were saying that before the kids were saying that, you know. It was easy to do that. And then just to see it all go to hell, starting basically, I believe, with the Tea Party movement in 2008.
Yeah, good call. It's the Richard Linklater line from, I think it's from Slacker, the movie. Withdrawal and disgust is not the same as apathy.
Which yes, is, that's right.
That's a good
one. That's great. I know. Perfect.
Speaking of
I'm drinking scotch, by the way. Why is this not scotch that I'm drinking?
It does look like it. What is that, apple juice? What is that?
Some sort of tea. It's like a, yeah, it's like a tea.
Yeah, yeah.
Flavored.
Usually when I'm on like a thing like this, a broadcast where I can see the person and there's drinking involved, it is some sort of brown liquor. So
right.
Not today. It's too early.
Brownest of the brown liquors. I love The Simpsons. It was Lionel Hutz, I believe, made that statement in court in The Simpsons. Did he not?
What is it? The brownest of the brown liquors, like that.
Yeah, no, yeah, and he was talking about bourbon specifically, brownest of the brown liquors. Miss you, Phil Hartman.
Oh my God, I love Lionel Hutz so much. I have a friend from college who went to law school, and he would tell me about it, and he couldn't tell me about law school without referencing Lionel Hutz two or three times. He'd be like, "Yeah, this we're learning about this. Remember when Lionel Hutz did the, you know." And
that's the best.
I don't know. So we were talking a little bit about SCOTUS and we were, you know, getting into this. And this is the question I have now, that it's clearly the system isn't working the way it's supposed to. These guys are clearly corrupt in a real way. Clarence Thomas is clearly he's corrupt. He's the amount of money going into his household and the ethics laws that nobody pays any attention to, you know, it's not illegal.
They don't pay attention to, it's that they don't apply to the Supreme Court.
Right.
They apply to every other federal judge.
Yeah. If it's not illegal, it certainly looks really fucking bad. Right. So then they pass these laws or they make these decisions that are horribly unpopular, that take stare decisis and just ignore it. Just like, fuck it. You know, we don't care about a law from 20 years ago. We're going to go back to 1864 when Arizona wasn't even a state yet. That sounds like something Lionel Hutz would say, right? 1864, Arizona is not even a state yet. So
very good.
And they're back there. And like after a certain point, especially with the Dobbs stuff, the temptation is to be like, this court has no legitimacy. It's just bullshit. And I don't care what they say. And at the end of the day, the whole way that this government functions is similar to the way that money functions. If we don't all collectively believe in it, absolutely, the system breaks down really fast. So I feel like the Supreme Court is in a situation now where we have to fix it or redress the problems there without hurting the institution and making the institution suffer from the, you know, the behavior of, you know, some of the only 9 people that are part of the institution. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, it, you know, there is a lot to say there. And, you know, first and foremost, I have to say the right, the Leonard Leos, the Federalists, they did a phenomenal job of making it a priority, investing in a quiet, long-term, long game, to get the people onto the Supreme Court who have a different view about how the law should be interpreted, topics like stare decisis. So their focus on getting that done really was, whether you think it's right or wrong, and Mitch McConnell's nastiest turtle you've ever seen in your life, whatever it is that you think, the point is they did it and they were focused and they did it for a long time and they absolutely ate our lunch.
They did.
And so now you have justices who have a different view of things like stare decisis. However, I will say that that was the thing that bothered me the most about Justice Thomas a long time ago, were his public statements on stare decisis, where he essentially, I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he essentially said, look, I don't believe in it. So, and it's like, wait, but that's literally the underpinning of our entire system, is when something's been decided, unless it was decided wrongly, right? So we go back to the Lochner era of the early 20th century, where we had the Supreme Court that kept saying, minimum wage laws, garbage, child safety laws in the workplace, garbage, you know, and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, that's when he said, I'm going to pack the court if you guys don't cut this crap out, this insane, not in the Constitution, right to contract without any interference from the government. That's not what the Constitution says. So then that's when the Supreme Court changed, boom, 1937 happened. Well, this is the inverse of that. That's kind of happened, which is, wait, we now have people who are like, yeah, you know, Roe and Casey was really the subsequent key case on abortion. Wrong. So we're just going to overturn the whole damn thing. And it's like, wait, you gave rights to people, women, 51% of our population, and you're going to say, we're going to take that right away. When has that happened?
It's never happened in our lifetime.
Right. And I mean, it's stuff like that. But it genuinely, if you don't like what's happening on the Supreme Court and their decisions, we have a couple of things. One, I am glad to hear the Judicial Council, you know, take an effort to deal with what's been happening with that one district in Texas. But the Supreme Court, the Senate is the only one who can do something about whatever it is you might believe is happening on the Supreme Court, such as ethics rules. You know, there was a lot of stink about that for a minute from Senator Whitehouse, I believe it was.
Oh, yeah. He's been diligent about it.
Yeah, but it didn't go anywhere. So if you can't elect people who care about these things, then you can't change it. So you've got to make an effort and you have to make it a priority. And if you're not going to do that, okay, then things aren't going to change. That's how our system is set up. So we have to have an organized group that makes it an effort, makes it an issue and a cause, and it can't just be Senator Whitehouse.
Yeah, I think Biden Harris should run on this. I think they should run to expand with a promise to expand the court.
It's not expand. I think that's the wrong phrase, and well, I wish people would stop saying it. No, let me. This is a hot topic for me.
Yeah, good. Okay,
it really is.
Tell me how to say it.
It's. Unpack the court. Mm. And I say that because historically, the last time the Supreme Court was expanded, right? We're unpacking by expanding it. I'm always worried when you say expand because that immediately becomes a political issue. It never should have been a political issue. I've been saying this for many, many years, long before where we are today with the Supreme Court, which is historically the number of justices equaled the number of circuits. So the last time it was expanded to 9 was, mid to late 1800s, right? 19th century. Because they had expanded the number of circuits to 9. It should always match the number of circuits. That's how it was intended and set up. And that's what the precedent, if we want to use the historical concept of it, if we're going to be originalists about how things happened, that's what it was. So there should be at least 11, if not 12, Supreme Court justices.
Well, okay, it's originalist, fine, but you know that might have been the case in the United States, but what about the territory of Arizona, Ethan?
Oh, I know.
What about that?
Didn't Alito cite something from like 1644 for his in Dobbs? Didn't
Oh, yeah, he's some witch burning law or something. It's Alito's.
I was really shocked at that. I mean, because if you're going to be an originalist, which I don't agree with, right? I'm not one of those people. I'm not an originalist. I think that that's just
stupid.
I mean,
you can say stupid because it is stupid. It is stupid. It's objectively stupid.
That is one way of saying it. I don't agree with originalism much at all. And I do agree that we do need to understand what intent is behind laws and our Constitution. That doesn't mean I've only adhere to that. That's ridiculous. But if you're going to be an originalist, at least be an originalist quoting the originalists. If you're quoting some dude from 1644 about a witch law, you're not an originalist anymore. Now you're a pick and choose historical maniac. I mean, I don't know what the word is, but it's like, now you're so far afield that you're going to find whatever it is to fit your narrative. You have a determined outcome and you're going to find whatever you need to make a logical, a supposedly logical conclusion to reach, you know, or path to reach that conclusion. I'm like going to start throwing stuff around my office now, Greg.
It's, well, there's
like,
no logic so to it. I mean, you know, your point is accurate because they cherry pick and there is no logic. They figure out, you said it exactly right. They figure out what outcome they want and then they write it backwards from that outcome. It's like a screenwriter who's like, this is how I want the movie to end. And then they write it backwards from there. And that's not how the law is like supposed to work. I'm not a lawyer. I didn't go to law school, but I'm pretty sure
that's not how it's supposed to work. Judges are not supposed to have a predetermined conclusion. Yeah. They're supposed to. I'm not trying to say this is what they did or didn't do on the Supreme Court, but what a judge is supposed to do, generally speaking, is the parties are supposed to argue the case. The judge is supposed to listen to their legal arguments put forth and determine which are better based on the facts, how the law applies. And the Supreme Court's different because they're making the policy for the land at a higher level. But to go just that far afield to me is really, you don't need to go back to 1644 to have a topic of things like abortion. Remember, in Judaism, for example, we do not consider an unborn fetus to be a full human yet. I mean, if you read the Old Testament, as Christians call it, or the Tanakh, as we would call it, it's not. I mean, it's a thigh bone. It's equivalent to a thigh bone. This whole idea of abortion being a life is this bizarre rewriting in the form of trying to control other people. Oh, well, we'll leave it up to the states. Oh, bull crap. You're not leaving it up to the states. You're already talking about a national ban, Project 2025, you jerks.
Yeah.
I mean, anyway.
Yeah. No, you're right about all that. Unsurprisingly, we are in agreement.
right?
So, okay, so we're coming on the hour, so I don't want to keep you too long.
Oh, gosh.
I've got one more question that I want to get to, and it's a long one, so you can answer it however you want. Wherever it takes you is totally fine. Okay. I don't know if you're aware of this, but like I said, we're recording this. It's Sunday, April 21st. A former president of the United States was in court last week during jury selection for his criminal trial, which begins tomorrow. This has never happened before, I don't think, in the history of the United States. So it's kind of a big deal, I guess. So I'm curious, and we can't get into the specifics of it because this won't run till Friday, and we don't want to, you know, guess at how many more times he's going to break wind in court or whatever he's going to do, or intimidate jurors or, you know, whatever he's going to do. But just in a general sense, how long do you think this trial will take? Like, what's the? I'm not big into like court procedurals, so. Is this going to take like a couple weeks, a couple months, or be over by Thursday? That's the first part of the question. Mm-hmm. We can go two at a time if you want.
So, yeah, I mean, so it's unprecedented. You can get mad at me about this or not, but I am not one who jumped on his alleged gaseousness in court. It's because there's really serious stuff that's happening in this case. I've talked quite a bit about the potential of the intimidation of witnesses and jurors. So that's where I have a full, I don't want to call it an explainer though, on the gag order. It was right that Judge Mershon properly weighed out the First Amendment rights of the defendant versus the danger to the judicial process. It is very serious what he has done with the social media and some of these other people. I believe I did a bit on Clay Travis's tweet that looked to be, you know, an attempt to influence potential jurors. That was not illegal, by the way, what he did. On its face, it's not, because New York penal law is pretty clear about what is and what is juror tampering. And it's not what he did on social media. Even if I think it's exceedingly distasteful, and Jesse Waters needs to be, you know, about this juror number two. It was horrible. I think it's horrible. Yeah. I think every media person who reported the biographical information of the jurors, very simple. On my radio shows, I never brought up the names of horrible criminals or alleged criminals because I don't want to add to their notoriety. I think you can do that as a media person. Never give out the biographical information of the jurors. And you can put a little asterisk with a note, editor's note. We're not releasing biographical information due to potential intimidation of jurors. Every media person should have done that, and they failed miserably in not doing that. And so Jesse Waters got good cover that New York Times shared biographical information on jurors, you know? I think it's horrible. I think that this is a very, very, very serious matter to allege what the underlying charge is really a misdemeanor, and it's enhanced into a felony because it was done with the intent to interfere in an election. That's harder to prove. D.A. Bragg could have left the misdemeanor level charges in there. He didn't. I know why he didn't, because he didn't want to leave the jurors an easy way out to say, oh, well, yeah, he falsified those business records, but we can't be sure if the intent was there of the election interference. I think that jurors are very, very good at seeing through BS. So I sure hope at the end of the day on Friday when Trump was leaving, Katie Fang reported that he said he wants to testify. I hope to hell he testifies. And there's no attorney on earth who's thinking he should testify. And criminal defendants have the right to testify regardless of what their attorney is saying, by the way. So all these people are like, his attorneys will stop him. He can't. He technically has the right. So how long do I think this trial is going to take based on your question? I mean, it's anywhere. It depends, which is what every lawyer responds with initially. It depends. But, you know, I think Judge Mershon himself said that the expectation is that this is 5 to 6 weeks.
Okay.
There's my long way to get to the answer to your question.
No, that's good. I don't know about this stuff, and I've been almost deliberately not following it closely because I'm just like, I don't need the little, you know, granular detail. Just let me know if he's guilty or not. That's, you know, I'm at that point now. So, and this is the last question, I promise, that I will release you to what I hope is a delightful sunny day in California.
It is. It's gorgeous outside, warm, sunny, Greg. Oh, it's just perfect here in LA.
It got cold here. It was nice this week, and now
Wait,
it's a little
you're not cooler. On the West Coast.
It's chillier. No, I am not. I'm on the East Coast where we still have a water supply. It's good. It's good out here.
We've got water. We just don't know how to properly
desalinate it. Yeah.
That's a whole separate show, Greg.
Okay, so let's say that he loses and he's found guilty. Because Michael Cohen was found guilty of the same thing. So, I'm not sure that he will. I think that this is by far the least sure outcome-wise of all the things he's been charged with. But let's say that he is found guilty. How do you think MAGA will perceive it if he's found guilty? Because will it puncture the bubble? Or is this, because it's such a kind of obscure thing to be guilty of, be written off as overreach? And will a certain segment of the MAGA population be like, you know, Democrats are just jealous because Trump was with the porn star, which I think is not an insignificant percentage of the thing. Like, do you think it will impact the election at all?
So one of the things that I hate about the Electoral College is the only people who matter that it would affect would live in what, those six swing states.
Yeah.
So if it affects a million people in California, it doesn't change the outcome. Joe Biden wins California. If it affects a million people in Texas, Donald Trump wins Texas. You know, Texas isn't quite a swing state yet. I love Beto and I love Power by People. And there's some great, wonderful people in the state of Texas. It's not blue yet. It's not even really purple yet, even though it is. So the number of people that have to be affected have to live in those swing states. And I think MAGA itself, if you're actually MAGA, he can be shooting people on Fifth Avenue, as Trump said, and it's not changing their vote. The key is how many people are left who are traditional conservatives who are not really MAGA, who will be turned off enough that whether or not they vote for Joe Biden, they don't vote for Donald Trump. I think that's a marginal number of people. And is it enough to swing the election? I wouldn't count on it. But so that's why everything that we do between now and November has to be registering voters, part one. Part two is, and this I actually did this with Power by People. I was volunteering with them. I guess it was the midterms. And I did some of the phone banking even with them. Don't get me started on a whole nother topic because I can, but we've got to make sure people have a plan for when, where, how they're going to vote.
Yeah.
It's one thing to register, and then we have to make sure that those people, well, not make sure, but make sure they have a plan for voting and hope that they do it. Because we can win simply by showing up. And we have to, and that's always our problem. And I am going to pick on my young Gen Z and young millennial friends. Every election, they talk a big game, and every election, they have very low turnout. They're the ones who can change the outcome more than we can. Although, Greg, I'm going to tell you something on the last note here. What the hell is wrong with Gen X that we seem to have the most staunch MAGA generation is Gen X?
I know. I saw that too. It made me so depressed. I thought we were
cool. What the hell?
I don't know. Too much Nirvana listening at high volumes. You know.
No, I'll tell you what it is. It was we were suspicious of the system.
Yeah, well.
We were the first generation that's like, this system sucks. We don't trust any of you. We don't trust that we believe that the baby boomers are stealing everything for themselves. They're destroying the planet. They claim to be this, yet they're the ones who became corporate. And they were the good, greed is good. 1980s wasn't Gen X. That was the boomers.
Right.
And I think that we were so jaded that we became susceptible to to Trump style populism.
Yeah, I think you're right, you know, because we're the first post-Vietnam generation, which is the first one that was raised to believe that the government was maybe not always on the up and up in a way that the generations previously had been led to believe that and raised.
By the way, I still have that.
Yeah.
I absolutely still have that. But I believe in women having full rights to bodily autonomy and equality. I fully support gay marriage. I'm absolutely have always fought for that. I believe in minorities being treated equally in every way. It's just I have all of that, and I'm suspicious of the government.
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. So I think there's a whole like religious. Evangelical religious kind of parallel Gen X group to the one that I'm familiar with that yeah. has existed this whole time. But I don't understand it. So I've sort of not been looking at it, but it's still that just because I don't look at it or engage with it much doesn't mean it's not there. And I mean, Ted Cruz is Gen X, for God's sake. Devin Nunes is Gen X. These people are like right around my age.
I just got flush with anger when you said those two names.
Right. And Ted Cruz likes all of the pop culture stuff that we like. He quotes it all the time. He just, a lot of these right-wing guys are deadheads, by the way. You know, they're
I did not even know that.
Yeah, Tucker Carlson's a deadhead. Mike Caputo is a deadhead. There's a lot of like deadheads that, you know, grew up and you know, which before we turn the microphones on and started recording, we were talking about how we are not deadheads. So, you know, good for us.
I never got into it. I just didn't. Never connected with me, Craig. Unlike your writing, which does connect.
Thank you. So before, where can people find you? Because I know you're still on the Elon Musk hell site. You're on Threads. You're on Instagram. Tell everybody where, you know, what's your handle in these places?
So on all the platforms except one, I'm just Ethan Bearman, which is like the animal bear and man. So it's B-E-A-R-M-A-N. And so I'm on all the platforms. On TikTok, I actually have a cousin who's younger than me, who's also named Ethan Bearman, who took that handle from me on TikTok before I could get it. I beat him on all the other platforms, but on TikTok, I'm Ethan Bearman, ESQ for Esquire. Okay. So on TikTok, actually, I've been posting stuff there. I just started doing that a couple of weeks ago, and I love the engagement on TikTok, actually.
I got to try this, I guess. So now that you've mollified my concerns that it's going to exist a week from now.
And by the way, I'm not going to mollify your concern that there's a genuine national security concern, but it'll still be there at least for the next couple of years.
Is there really? I mean, you know, if I don't know.
Chinese Communist Party, man. No. Love the Chinese people, love so many things about Chinese culture. I've been to China. I've studied with a Shaolin monk from China. I love the history. Just so much to love about China. Chinese Communist Party is truly part of the axis of evil on Earth right now.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that, like, what, you know, anybody that wants to find me based on my cell phone, they're going to find me. I feel like...
Oh, well, especially those of us who are kind of public in the first place, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, look, I'm an attorney in Los Angeles. I practice law. By law, I have stuff that's public.
Yeah. Yeah.
Being a member of the state bar, there's a requirement for certain things to be public of mine on the state bar website, let alone I've been in media forever. So yeah, I'm everywhere. You can find me. Chinese already have all my info anyway, because I went to China.
Right. And they know. They know what's going on. So as always, and again, okay, so we hit like maybe a third of the questions, which means that this was a very good interview, because if we hit all of them, it's boring. So Ethan Bearman, great to see you. Thanks so much for taking the time with me today. Really appreciate it.
Hey, Greg. So I'm going to give you a little Yiddish to end my little piece today. And I say this with deep love and sincerity, which is Sei gesund, which means good health. We say that when we leave, we want you to have good health. We want you to be well. I want you to have good health. I want you and all of your loved ones stay healthy, stay sane, go enjoy yourselves as well in these times of political insanity. And I ask that for everybody who's listening right now, too. I wish you great health. And I can't wait to talk to you again soon, Greg, okay?
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. I'm going to take that to heart. I give it a hearty amen.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. be kind to each other, try and enjoy yourself, and until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.